and sisters, we're here again. Now, it's like our chairman said, every time you think about Isaiah 35, you say it's a vision of the kingdom. It is. But brothers and sisters, there's another facet in this chapter that is absolutely amazing. And hopefully we'll be able to sketch that for you tonight. I just want to lay this out for you and just see where this chapter's going. Because it is a vision of the kingdom. There's no question of that. But I'm certain that many of you are going to be surprised to see the other facet in this chapter. It really is a surprise. But before, we can't do anything about that in chapter 35 unless we look at chapter 34. Now, this sets the background for chapter 35. And I don't very much in this chapter at all. I'm just going to sketch a few things for you. Just three or four things here I want to sketch for you. And then we'll go straight into chapter 35, and I'm almost certain you're going to see where we're going. So this is the chapter that's the background to this one here. So first of all, we read in the first three verses, there's an international crisis, right? It's the time of Christ's return. Come ye, ye nations, to hear and hearken, ye people. Let the earth hear and all that is therein, the world and all things that have come forth of it. Listen to this, says the prophet. This is a worldwide event. For the indignation of Yahweh is upon all nations, his fury is upon their armies, he will utterly destroy them and deliver them to the slaughter and so on. So that's the opening of that chapter. So here's the great day of Armageddon, the great day of judgment, brothers and sisters, for which this world is fully ripe. We come down to verse 8. And verse 8, to that, the thought of verse 8 is talking about the day of Yahweh's vengeance. It is the day of Yahweh's vengeance. And the year of the recompenses of the controversy of Zion. That's based upon the Day of Atonement, which in the 49th year of their history, from that day, they dated the coming year of Jubilee. That's what it's talking about. It's the day of Yahweh's vengeance and the year of his redeemed. So it's based upon that facet of Leviticus chapter 16. So this is the purpose for which the Lord is coming. Now what's he going to do? From 9 to 12, what he's going to do, he's going to clean this world out. He's going to clean it right out, brothers and sisters. Look at verse 12. You just need to read this one verse. They shall call the nobles thereof the kingdom, but none shall be there. And all her princes are gone. So they'll call for the kings and the princes and the great men of this world. They don't exist. He is going to denude the world, brothers and sisters, of all that corruption and get rid of the whole bang lot of it. But look at these verses. The unclean animals are going to possess the land. The unclean animals, verse 16 and 17. It gives a list of them. I'm going to put them on the screen in a minute, give you a look at the list of them. Seek ye out the book of Yahweh and read. No one of these shall fall. None shall want her mate. For my mouth it hath commanded, and his spirit it hath gathered them. And he hath cast a lot for them, and his hand hath divided it unto them by line. They shall possess it forever. From generation to generation shall they dwell therein. So out go all the aristocracy of this world, and in go all the most grotesque creatures in the world. Now just have a look, brothers and sisters, at this list. You will never find a list like this anywhere in the whole of the Bible where animals are grouped together of this nature. The corvids of the island, the owl, the satyr, the raven, the screech owl, the dragon, the great owl, the owls, the vultures, wild beasts of the desert. Creatures that look like that. They're the people that's going to inherit the world. Just think of that, because this is what chapter 35 is about. It's going to end like that in a most remarkable fashion. This chapter is going to be carted straight into the New Testament, and we're going to see it in action. It's a remarkable thing. It really is. Now, here's Rotherham's translation of those verses. That the vomiting pelican... This is the meaning of the Hebrew terms. That the vomiting pelican and the bittern may possess it, and the great owl and the raven shall dwell therein. Then will he stretch over it the line of desolation and the plummet of emptiness. Her nobles, but none are there. Unto royalty will call, all her princes shall become to naught. They're not there. Then shall come up in her palaces thorns and nettles, thistles in her fortress, and she shall become a home for wild dogs, an enclosure for ostriches. Then shall the criers meet with the howlers, and the shaggy creature unto his fellows shall call. Have you ever heard such language? Look, the vomiting pelican, the bittern, the great owl, the raven, wild dogs, ostriches, criers, howlers, and shaggy creatures. The world is going to be possessed by those. From generation to generation, they will possess the world, brothers and sisters. Here's the rest of the chapter. Only there shall be the night spectre, shall make her settlement and find for herself a place of rest. There shall the arrow snake make her nest and lay and hatch and gather under her shadow. Only there shall be gathered the falcons, every one with her mate. Seek ye out the scroll of Yahweh and read. Not one among them is lacking, none is missing her mate. For a mouth it hath commanded, and his spirit itself gathered them. Yea, he himself hath cast them for a lot, and his own hand hath given it to them, a portion by line. Unto time's age abiding shall they possess it, to generation shall they dwell therein. Now, brothers and sisters, here is a few more creatures as you can add to your list. And they're going to dwell there. Who are the they? Now, I've already suggested who they are. How do we know that? Well, because it says that. It says they're going to possess the world. Now, you know, there is no division of chapter and verse in the original Hebrew, is there? I mean, the translators put that there, and we're glad of that. It's very handy for us, extremely helpful. But in the original Hebrew, it's all written as one book. So we've just got to go to the next verse to find out who they are. Here they are. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad. Well, who's the them? It's those creatures. We just read about them. And the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it. The excellency of Carmel and Sharon, they shall see the glory of Yahweh. Here's the they, that's who they are. And the excellence of our God. So, brothers and sisters, those creatures that you saw are these people that Paul talks about. They're you and I. Now, I didn't see anybody looking like that picture right on there tonight, coming dressed like that with horns out of their head. But that's how we appear at times, by our behaviour, the way we think, the base instincts of our nature. That's how we appear before the Creator until he changes us. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, they're not there. Isaiah 34 said that there's no room for them, they disappeared. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And base things of the world, and things which are despised, hath God chosen. Yea, the things which are not, to bring to naught the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. So the they of Isaiah 35 are all those wild creatures, and I say there's no list anywhere in the Bible, anywhere near to the extent of that list of unclean creatures, nor of the type of unclean creatures. Howlers and criers and shaggy creatures, all that Hebrew language heaped in there, brothers and sisters, to tell us who's going to be the kings and priests in the kingdom of God. And I say this to you all, brothers and sisters, to encourage... all of us, I think, who are simple-minded folk, we wouldn't be in this hall baptised here if we were not. If we belong to the noble of this world, to the wise who know everything except the word of God, we would not be in this list. And it's a great encouragement to read Paul's words. And we've got brothers running around this country and sticking things on the net, brothers and sisters, about theistic evolution, which is a load of absolute poppycock. It's rubbish and garbage. And they profound themselves to be, they propound themselves to be to wise. They call themselves wise, says Paul in Romans, but they are fools. These are the people that are wise, the people that the world calls fools. The nobility of this world would never borrow us, brothers and sisters. We don't reach their standard, but they won't be there in the kingdom. They won't be there. But people who love God, who know their weaknesses, who understand that we are unclean creatures, but we try and do something about it, they're the people that God is going to make this kingdom and build that kingdom forevermore for their sake, brothers and sisters. That's who the them are. But there is a glory of the kingdom. My word, there is. Now, there are visions of that. I've only made two great divisions here of this talk. There are great reversals in nature and blessings for the oppressed among mankind in those verses. And in the final section, there's a glorious highway to the kingdom, brothers and sisters, now thronged with joyous people, unburdened from the sorrows of this life. We're going to see Billy Gerd back in here. Bill Temple back in here, brothers and sisters. And you'll be told later on, of course, tonight that our brother Warren passed away today. We're going to see Warren there. That's what we're going to see. And it's going to be terrific. And all the sorrows of this life are going to go behind us, brothers and sisters. All of them, swept out of the way. That's what this chapter's about. That's the division. Now let's look at some of the great reversals. Now you know what they are. The wilderness will become, waters will break out. Solitary place, gladness. The desert blossoms as a rose. Parched land, pools of water. Thirsty land, springs of water. You know, brothers and sisters, you don't have to have much of an imagination, do you? When you travel in our country, well, just take a map and have a look at the populated areas of Australia. Just have a look at it. It's like a man like I am, a bald head. It's populated around the coasts and it's desert in the interior. It's just nothing. But look at the extent of that territory. And can you imagine when the earthquake reshapes this world, brothers and sisters, changes the course of nature, when climate change is a thing of the past and God cleans up the pollution and the world starts to gear up again and to act as it was created to act. And you can imagine the waters breaking out in that desert, and what will follow the water will be verdure. Grass and trees and flowers and fruit, brothers and sisters, and there'll be vast tracts of land. There'll be no problem of bringing the people and dispersing them through the world. The Gobi Desert, the Sahara Desert, the Simpson Desert. You look at them, these huge expanses. What a vision that is. You know, one of the greatest visions that you can have is water. Water's a magic thing. It's marvellous, brothers and sisters, what water will do. Want to see it work? Go and put fertiliser on your lawn. Go and put fertiliser in your garden and you'll get some result. Go out the next day after it rains and have a look. You ever notice that? Especially in your lawn. Put fertiliser on it. Yeah, it's a bit greener. A nice shower of rain, half inch or so, next day. It's absolutely brilliant. Because, you see, it gathers the nitrogen, doesn't it, as it comes down. And the other mineral, and it affects the ground. God does that, brothers and sisters. That's one of my greatest visions of the kingdom. I want to be in the kingdom. I'd be very happy to be given the task of going out and helping people to do their farming and see that done in that glorious land, the way when God changes that. Absolutely beautiful. But there are more reversals. Now look at these two verses in Isaiah. The earth mourns, anguishes. Why? Because Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. And Sharon is like a wilderness. And Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. Now you will notice, of course, the three that are coloured in blue. Lebanon, Sharon and Carmel. Well, they're going to be turned around. Because it says, it shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing, and the glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it. The excellency of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of Yahweh and the excellency of our God. They're going to be changed. Dramatic changes to those three situations in the land. Exceptional changes. Now look at this. Here's a photograph of Lebanon, okay? This was taken, brothers and sisters, about 1969. These are a grove of olive, of the cedar trees, rather. There's about 500 of them in that grove. Behind them towers up the range of Lebanon itself. Lebanon means white, and you can understand why it means white. That range, brothers and sisters, those two ranges, they run down on an angle about that, if you're looking at the map of Israel, on an angle about that, from the top of Israel, in the country of Lebanon, they run for over 100 miles northeast. And they're divided by a very great valley called the Bekaa Valley, which means a valley between two mountains. And these two twin mountains ranges run down. I've been from one end of them to the other. And we went right down the centre, brothers and sisters. It was a magnificent day. All right, you don't see those trees like they are there now, but that's what they'll you see. There's only one other grove of them further back in the mountains where there's a few thousand. You just can't get there. They only get to these trees. But just think of this, that in the day when Solomon got his timber from there, the cedars of Lebanon went up to the tree line on both sides of those mountains. Imagine it. And we've got a, you know, we've got a hymn which says, "Let Lebanon cedars rustle their boughs and fill the scented air." I have done that. I've actually stood in that grove and done that. Ankle deep in snow, brothers and sisters, there was a gentle breeze blowing through those cedars. And you could not believe that the scent that came off those leaves. It was absolutely beautiful to stand there. If you lifted your arms, you wouldn't need any deodorant in the morning. It was just beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful. And the air was pristine. Just imagine them right along the whole length of those mountains on both sides of that valley. Like Isaiah in chapter 33 said, they're all languishing now. But the day is going to come when that's all going to be brought back again to what it used to be. The excellency of Carmel. The excellency of Carmel. Feed thy people with thy rod, the flock of thine heritage, which dwell solitary in the wood, in the midst of Carmel. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead, as in the days of old. Now, can you imagine this? You see, Carmel, brothers and sisters, is that long, slither, as you might say, on the screen of a mountain range going out to the northwest. Okay? Carmel is not one hill. It's a range of hills. Now, you go out, right out at the top, of course, that's Mount Carmel proper, and it looks down over there. There's the Haifa there, and the city of Haifa, and the beach, and the Mediterranean Sea is in front of you. And it's out there pointing in a northwest direction. Whenever Israel's summer broke and the rains came, brothers and sisters, the autumn rains come in order that they may sow their crops, the very first point that felt that wind and rain was the tip of Carmel. And in the Hebrew traditions, it has it that they'd set a watchman on the top of Carmel. And his job was that immediately he saw, like Elijah's servant saw, exactly like that. Immediately he saw any sign of rain coming over a long, hot, parched summer, he would blow a trumpet. It would be picked up by other watchmen who were strategically placed right down the land. And trumpet after trumpet after trumpet was telling the people, "It's raining!" And we in Australia know what that means, brothers and sisters, at times of long droughts, which of course often come upon this country. And such was the fruitfulness, and that's what Carmel means. Lebanon means white, but fruitfulness is the meaning of Carmel. Such was fruitfulness, brothers and sisters, that in Amos' prophecy, when Amos was depicting the tragedy that has come upon Israel, he talked about the way that God would punish them by bringing the droughts upon the land. And one of the things he said, the very last thing he said was, "And Carmel shall wither." When Carmel withers, everything's gone. Because that's the one that first of all got the refreshing rain that broke the summer droughts upon the land. Isaiah certainly knew his land, and no doubt about that. And Sharon. Sharon shall be a fold of flocks in the valley of Achor, a place for herds to lie down in, for my people that have sought me. You see, Sharon means a plain. And of course, you're looking up north, and what you're seeing up the top there, that mountain range, that's this side of Carmel. That's the southern side of Carmel. We were looking at the other side of that from that previous slide. Now we're on the southern side of it, and we're looking down the coastal plain here along the Sharon here, which is extremely fertile, of course, because the hills of Judea, the rain plummets off of them and spreads its way right across that valley, and it's a place of flocks. You go there today, you take a picture there, and you will see acre after acre, mile after mile of vineyards. Breeders' grass, vineyards. The only thing that mars it today is the Gaza Strip. But you'll see vineyards going up there. And you'll see olives, brothers and sisters. And you'll see fields for flocks. Beautiful. This is what's going to happen, brothers and sisters, in the future. So that's what we see going on. Now, in this chapter we read this, verse 3. Strengthen ye the weak hands and confirm feeble knees. That's what Paul said in Hebrews 12, isn't it? Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Now these are days, brothers and sisters, when knees are feeble and some people can't walk straight, especially when you get around about our age. It's very hard sometimes to walk straight. That's the natural things, of course, but they are talking about spiritual impediments too, aren't they? We need, brothers and sisters, to have very straight paths for our feet. Very straight paths. And they need to be old paths, because they're the ones you know better. Don't ever, ever be put off from the very simplicity of the truth which you all understand. Don't ever feel inferior to the so-called wisdom of this world. Just strengthen yourself with the view that's true, brothers and sisters, that we have a very straight path and we know it well. We'd never be in the truth if we didn't. We don't have to get lost. If we get lost, we're blind. With our eyes open, we know that path. We've walked on it for years and we're not getting off of it. That's what that's telling us. And if the knees start getting wobbly and you feel they're going to collapse, well, you just got to take a deep breath and strengthen those knees. That's what the apostle's saying, and this is what he's getting it out of this chapter. So you can imagine why he took it out of this chapter, because there's every good thing in here to strengthen the hands and the knees and the feet, brothers and sisters, isn't there? Every good thing we need is in there. So you don't do that. Now it goes on to tell us this. In verse 5, the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. That's interesting. Why is it interesting? Well, for this reason, brothers and sisters, the deaf and the blind are cured, right? Now just look, here's two chapters in Mark. They follow after the other, chapter 7 and chapter 8. In chapter 7, we read about a deaf man of the Gentile region of Decapolis. Now, Decapolis was just east, or right along the way along the border east of the Lake of Galilee, a bit to the south, and then, of course, it spread over and took in the border of Jordan, all around the bottom end of Galilee. There was a special over there called Decapolis, which means the 10 cities, Decapolis, the 10 cities. And they were the cities established by the Greeks. When the Grecian Empire occupied those territories, it was the Greeks who established that area and made it a special region only for Gentiles who could live in that region comfortably and not have to mix with the Jewish people. It's especially done for that. When the Greeks were swept out of the way by the Romans, brothers and sisters, the Romans thought that was a champion idea, and they kept that going. So the Romans continued that policy. That was a special area, Decapolis, the 10 cities. And of course, it was the Gentile area. And a deaf man was healed here. Again, departing from the coast of Tyre and Sidon, he came out of the Sea of Galilee, through the midst of the coast of Decapolis. And they bring unto him one that was deaf and had an impediment in his speech. And they beseech him to put his hand upon him. And he took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers in his ears, and he spit and touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said unto him, Epaphratha, that is, be open. And straightway his ears were open, and the string of his tongue was loosed, and he spake plain. Can you imagine that, brothers and sisters? Jesus, he goes up to this man. He took him aside from the multitude. He put his fingers in the man's ears. He spat on the ground and touched the man's tongue. And the man couldn't hear him. He'd have to lip read. So he would say very emphatically, "Be opened." Whoosh! That's what Paul did to the Gentiles, didn't he? He went into a deaf world, didn't he? A totally deaf world. And he opened many eyes, didn't he? They were open, brothers and sisters. Marvellous. They heard this man speak. Never heard anything like it before. Never heard about the gospel of the kingdom of God or the hope of Israel. They were all non-Israelites. And their ears were open, weren't they? The next chapter, Jesus heals a blind man. Just watch the situation. A blind man is given his sight at Bethsaida, the house of fish, the hometown of at least four of the apostles. Peter and John were in that town. And two of the other apostles were brought up in that town. It was very much a Jewish town, just this side of the border of Decapolis. On the northeastern corner of the Lake of Galilee, just there, is Bethsaida. It's where Jesus fed the multitude with the fishes and the loaves in that particular spot. It was altogether Jewish, and the Jews are blind. They're not deaf, but they're blind. Now just look what happened. And just think about all these unclean creatures that are getting clean, brothers and sisters. Just think about it. He cometh to Bethsaida, and they bring a blind man unto him and besought him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. Do you know what Jesus was doing at that very moment of history? He was doing exactly that with his disciples. It was the time, brothers and sisters, that he led them out into the north, away from all the hullabaloo that was going on over his ministry, to confirm the truth with them. He was actually doing that when they bring this blind man to him. So Jesus takes him by the hand and leads him out of the town. Just exactly what he was doing with them. And when he spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw aught. And he looked up and said, "I see men as trees walking." That's exactly the problem of the apostles. That is exactly the problem that Jesus had with his disciples. Who would be the greatest? They saw men out of all proportion to what they really were. That was the problem. That was why he was leading them up to the north, to convince them of that, which the later on record tells us. And here's a Jew, and he's blind, and the first thing he sees is men out of all proportion to what they really are. And the record goes on and he says, "I see men as trees walking." After that, he put his hands again upon his eyes, and that's what he had to continually do with those disciples. Jesus didn't give them one lesson, brothers and sisters. He never ceased to point out time and again, "Have you no faith? Are ye so blind? Don't you understand that? Haven't you understood what I've said?" Again and again, he made him look up, and he was restored and saw every man clearly. Now Isaiah says the deaf and the blind are going to be cured. Isn't it interesting that they are in chapter 7 and 8 of Mark, those things? And you know, brothers and sisters, the truth is remarkable. You know, it turns foolish, uneducated people into brilliant people. I mean brilliant. Because we sit here today, all the nobility of this world wouldn't want nothing to do with us, the Christadelphians, are just a mad lot of people who even believe the Jews are good. But not good, of course, but they think they're good. And they wouldn't have nothing to do with us. And Paul goes to tell us in Corinthians, brothers and sisters, that they don't understand the word we're saying. They can't understand where we're coming from. But he tells us that we know exactly where they're coming from. You read Corinthians and for yourself and you pick that up. He talked about the spirit that's in man, the spirit of discernment. And he said, they don't know what you're on about. But we know exactly what they're on about. Why? Because we've seen it from God's eyes. And we know what we're like. We know what we're like. And we can see ourselves in those people, except we got the truth now. We're trying to be different. But we know exactly what the problem is. This is what the problem with the blind men of Bethsaida were. He didn't know that. First glimpse to him, a man was a great tall tree. It took another touch, another spittle, to make everything become very clear about man. See what Isaiah's on about, brothers and sisters? It's quite incredible. Incredible. And then he says this, you see. The lame man, the lame shall leap as the hart. Now, isn't this incredible? That the opening miracle performed by a Jew, Peter, the lame man at the temple, and the opening miracle to the Gentiles was the lame man at Lystra. By the time they got to Asia Minor, that is, of course, he'd been to the island of Patmos. But when they got actually on the area of their main mission, brothers and sisters, the first miracle performed by Paul was the lame man at Lystra. So Peter to the Jews, Paul to the Gentiles, and they were the first miracles. And they have this in common. They both never walked from their mother's womb. They both looked steadfastly on the apostles, and they both leapt and walked. It's exactly that order in the first of those miracles. Do you reckon these things are recorded like that by accident? This is Isaiah 35 coming alive, brothers and sisters. It really is. We're seeing it. We're seeing this chapter really coming alive. Now, in verse 8 to 10, a highway shall be there, we're going to read later on. Now let's have a look at this highway. There shall be a highway there. Okay. Here's what they did with highways. And it shall be shown, build up. This is the RSV. Prepare the way. Remove every obstacle from my people's way. That's an incredible figure. It's an incredible figure. You know, you can read that quickly, but just have a look what that's saying. So here we are, the Enfield Ecclesia. We want to make our way to the kingdom. There's only one way to the kingdom. There are no devious routes to the kingdom. It's all straight. Highway's very, very straight. But brothers and sisters, in these times and seasons, as it's always been, there's a lot of rubble on that road. There are a lot of dangerous objects. They could hinder the approach of anyone to the end of that road, couldn't they? What do? Well, you build up. You know what that's saying? What you do is, because you know your brother and sister's coming behind you, and some of them may be old folk, feeble folk, some may have doubts and fears and all sorts of things. So you're conscious of them. So as you make your way up that highway with your friends, you pick up every obstacle. You don't throw it away. You mark the boundary of it. You put the obstacle where the boundary is. So the very problem that would have tripped people up now becomes a direction in which they've got to go, because you've handled it properly. You've done the right thing. You haven't thrown it just willy-nilly off to the side. You make sure that everybody can see that obstacles, they're either side of us, and as long as the road in the middle's clear, we'll all get to the kingdom. But if that road's not clear, then we won't get to the kingdom. Don't tell simple people that God created Adam mortal, prone to sin. Don't dare tell them that. Don't you dare tell them that. You know, brother, I'm very passionate about this, as you can see, and I mean it. It's not the issue of all this so-called scientific knowledge that's wrong, brothers and sisters. That's not the issue. It's not the issue as who's right and who's wrong. The issue is that God loves simple-minded people, and they are defenseless against so-called brilliance. Don't put an obstacle in their way. You'll pay for that. That's what that verse is telling us. Go through. Go through the gates. Prepare the way. Cut the highway. Same thing. gather out the stones, get rid of the obstacles, and then put up a signpost, this way. We had that done Sunday morning by Colin, Brother Colin. It was a magnificent exhortation, brothers and sisters, believe me. That was a magnificent exhortation. Very clear, that's the way. Get rid of the stones, and the very stones themselves, when they're put aside and put out there, they're pointing the way to the kingdom. You don't go that way and you don't go that way, just go down through the middle of them. That's where you go. That's what I was talking about. Ye shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear Yahweh your God. I am Yahweh. And that's the one we fear, brothers and sisters, above all else. Some people describe fear, just means a reverence. It means fear. Because he has tremendous, tremendous power to save or destroy us, brothers and sisters, and there will be no answer to him. When that fear is in you, and it's in me, then it will be out to defend anything that's offensive to him. That fear has got to be in us all. Let us not therefore judge one, but judge this rather, that no man put a stumbling block or occasion to fall in his brother's way. That's what they did in the old times with the highway. Make sure their brother didn't trip over what was on that road. Get it out of the way. And imagine those days too, brothers and sisters, roads weren't bitumized like we have them. So there were some dangerous tracks. Now this is the use of the root word for highway. It's rather interesting. The way of the slothful man, a hedge of thorns, but the way of the righteous is made plain. That's the same word for highway. So a righteous man makes things plain. This is what it means, this. It's very plain. Because my people have forgotten me. They have burned incense to vanity. They have caused them to stumble in their ways from the ancient paths, to walk in paths in a way that is not cast up. In other words, the stones haven't been removed. They're still there. But the ancient paths, Brother Thomas, brothers and sisters, if he had been removing literal stones for every difficulty he took out of our way, he'd have gone to his grave bent over like a bow. His back would have been broken. He got rid of more stones than I think any of us all put together. He got them rid of them all. You read your Elpis, Israel, Eureka and everything else, and he just demolishes them one after the other and makes it very plain it's that way. And it's as simple as ABC. That brother is to be commended, brothers and sisters, and he made a path for hundreds if not thousands of Christadelphians today who are treading that path, and people have gone before them have trodden. It was Brother Thomas, not alone, but he was a tremendous worker, and so was Brother Roberts, and they did nothing else but remove obstacles and show that the way was very plain. Well, that's what the highway is going to be. Thus saith Yahweh, stand ye in the ways and see and ask for the old path. Where is the good way? And walk therein, and you shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we don't want to do that. We will not walk therein. The old paths. You know, sometimes we get a corrupted view of that because a break-off fellowship calls themselves the old paths. Not talking about them. It's talking about the old paths of this book, the highway that Isaiah is talking about. A highway, brothers and sisters, that's laid by the truth and kept clean by the people who are walking on it, removing obstacles that have nothing to do with that plain path. That's what it's all about. And so you see, that's what it's here. And then you'll notice in this, in verse 8 we get down to now, it says this, a highway shall be called the way of holiness, and the unclean shall not pass over. Now you might say to me, there you go, Brother John, you're wrong, because you said the unclean will pass over it. Brothers and sisters, when that sheet got let down from heaven in Acts chapter 10 to send Cornelius off to a hated Gentile, he was a Gentile, right? Hey, he was a Roman Gentile. Really? A Roman? Yeah. And I'll tell you something else. He's a general in the Roman army. You're kidding. No. How many men's he got? 100. A centurion. 100 men, yeah. Really? And you know what the name Cornelius it means, brothers and sisters? I don't know what it means. I'll tell you, I know where it came from. It was what they called a patrician name in Roman history. That is, a famous family Roman, a famous family of Rome at the time of Cornelius. He was a member of that family. He had everything about him that would make a Jew vomit. That's why God let down all these unclean creatures and the sheep. Because Peter's attitude to him would have been abominable. He wouldn't go near him. And he let down that, and Peter, rise and kill Peter. No, 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 I won't do that. Leviticus 20 said I can't do that. And he was not wrong in saying that, because that's what Leviticus 20 did say. Now, God wasn't contradicting himself. He said, yeah, that's right. But Peter, I can clean them. I don't have to bring clean people for you. I can do that, Peter. Don't you call what I've cleaned unclean. That's why we have this chapter. These people that we've been talking about earlier, they're not like that anymore, brothers and sisters. They're not like that. They are clean people. And then we read this in verse 8. Now look at this. Because this really is where this point really turns. And a highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools shall not err therein. Now, simply speaking, it's talking about our highway of holiness. It's saying that people who try to make their lives a life of holiness and keep themselves as clean as they can, they're the ones that's going to pass over that, and fools won't go down there. But there's something in this verse, brothers and sisters, that's fascinating. I want you to look at the margin. It says, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men. Now the margin says, for he shall be with them. And the reason for that, brothers and sisters, is because the Hebrews in the singular. Now this is absolutely magnificent in my view. Here is this highway, all these unclean animals representing the simple folk of this world, the despised, you know, the people who've got no nobility, the people of the world that got no time for, they're all there, brothers, now cleansed of God. They're making way up this highway, and there's another one on that highway with them. He shall be there. Now just look at Rotherham's translation. Jesus Christ. And there shall be a raised way, even a high road. And the high road of holiness shall it be called. There shall not pass over it one who is unclean, but he himself shall be one of them travelling the road, and the perverse shall not stray thereinto. He himself shall be one of them travelling the road. There won't be any unclean people there, brothers and sisters. It's in the singular. But there's one single person then singled out as being important, and he's just one of them travelling on that road. Now don't miss that. So here he is, but he's not alone. There are others travelling with him. Now, show you the application. And they came to Jericho, a city of curse. And as he went out of Jericho, his disciples and a great number of people, blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway, begging. Have a look at this. And when he heard it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, thou son of David, have mercy on me. And many charged him, should hold his feet. Shut up, they'd say to him, be quiet. But he cried out more than a great deal. Thou son of David. Look who he's calling upon, brothers and sisters. The sure mercies of David, Isaiah 55. What's sure about David's mercies? Adultery with your next door neighbour's wife. A man living next to David is no mean person. He happened to be a convert from the truth, from the world. He was a Hittite. He was a man of incredible integrity. And David goes, while he's out fighting for David's safety and the safety of Israel, David's home wandering around with an empty mind at that time. looking down at the top of his roof and saw that woman and took hold of her and committed adultery with her. And then when she was with child, he then sat down and plotted that man's death, who was number 39 in his army, and his army numbered hundreds of thousands, and he was the third captain over the army. Imagine his status in Israel. And when he was sent back by Joab, and David got Joab, who he had no time for, to connive with him to get that man killed in battle. And when it was all over, brothers and sisters, I'm not here to denounce David. God forbid I should do that. But it's what I'm saying is true. It's true. Terrible crime. Terrible. Terrible crime. Adultery with a woman of a man of that stature. And then cold-blooded murder by the hands of a man that he had no time for. And when Nathan stood there, the prophet, by the word of Yahweh, and said, "Thou art the man," in the next breath, said to David, "But Yahweh hath put away thy sin." Now, who's got a list in this hall of sins like David? Many of us, probably if not all of us, have thought in our minds evil things about men and women. But I doubt too many of us committed adultery. And I don't think we got any murderers. And in the very next breath, he didn't say, "I'll give you 12 months to put it right. You've got to do this or do that." He said, no. In the very next breath. You know, brothers and sisters, that changed David forever. And there are two Davids in the record, one before and one after Bathsheba, and nothing alike. And when that blind man called out, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Look at the impact that would have had on the Lord. And what about his mind? And do you know the only other person that I know of, at any rate, that did that? Was the woman of Syrophoenicia, of whom Jesus said was a dog, come from a scum district, eroded by the sexual immorality of the age, and she was the other one who used that term, "Son of David, heal my daughter." And this man sat by the highway, and they called the blind man. He said, "You go and call them." Now, would you do that? If you've got a blind man, are you going to call a blind man to you? A blind man? Certainly not. You're going to walk over to him. But he gets the Jews to call this blind man near Jericho, and his name means, brothers and sisters, the son of the unclean. And he's standing on a highway, or sitting beside the highway. That's Isaiah 50, 30, 35. There's no question of that. And he cast away his garment, rose and came to Jesus. And Jesus answered and said unto him, "What wilt that I should do unto you?" The blind man said unto him, "Lord, that I may receive my sight." Jesus said unto him, "Go thy way, thy faith hath made thee whole." And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus in the way. And he shall be with them in the highway, says Isaiah. And among them the blind, brothers and sisters. Now if we haven't got that plain, just note. Jericho, city of a curse. Bartimaeus, son of the unclean, because of the meaning of Timaeus. Now, think about that. Don't just loosely just pass that by. Son of the unclean. What's that mean? Well, what does this mean? Son of man. That's Jesus' title. And we learn in John's Gospel it's a title of strength and not weakness. So, son of man means, brothers, nothing else but this. He represented all mankind on that cross. That's what it means. When the Son of Man is lifted up, he represents all mankind. Well, who does this guy represent? Who do you think Bartimaeus represents? Son of the unclean. All those creatures you saw on that screen. He represents all of them. He's the lowest of the low. He couldn't be any lower. And he's right down there in Jericho. He's blind. He's by a highway. He's commanded to be called. Jews have got to call a Gentile. And Jesus said, go on your way. And in the Greek, it literally means, go your own way. Did he go that way? He followed Jesus in the way. He didn't go his own way. And where was Jesus heading? Into the very centre of all the Jewish opposition to people like him. Because he was the son, the representative of them all. That's what they all should, according to the Jews, that's what they all should be, sitting on the dirt, blind, and just begging for their meat. That's where they all should be. And he's going towards Jerusalem with Jesus. What an incredible story, brothers and sisters. What an incredible story that is. The way of holiness. And he himself shall be with them. Now, you know, the chapter finishes in verses 9 and 10, and will finish in verses 9 and 10, with a complete change. You see, it says, no lion shall be there, brothers and sisters, nor any ravenous beast. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. And the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. You've probably all seen the nature films we often see, you know, these ones that are put out. They're fascinating. I love them. I'm a great lover of those nature films and so forth. And you put them on, when you see these animals getting torn to the ground, these beautiful deer, you know, with beautiful, big, luminous eyes, you know, and lovely-looking faces and so forth, you see them ripped to bits, brother. You won't see that anymore. Do you know, it's incredible. When God made the world, it was incredible. He made this world, and he made all these creatures, and he brought them to Adam to name them. Adam had that privilege. He was Lord of that creation. God made him the keeper of that garden, Lord of that creation that God had made. And he was in charge of it. And he brought those up, and you know, in the very language that's used here, that the way he brought those animals up, and he named them all brothers and sisters. So he had a rapport with them. And he was a vegetarian, and they ate the grass of the field. There was nobody tearing anybody's meat around. It was herbs for man and grass for the beasts. Nobody was killing anybody or spilling anybody's blood to live. And Adam was on par with those animals. And then, of course, he plucked the fruit off the tree, and the dam burst, didn't it? And it burst, brothers and sisters, in torrential rain that drowned the world. With only 8 people got out of the ark. And when they got out of the ark, God repeated to Noah the words that he told Adam, with this difference. With this difference. He said, I'm going to have to put the fear of the animals in you. Or rather, the fear of you in the animals. I'm going to put the fear of you in those animals. Why did he have to do that? Clear why. Because men by this time were well and truly into their meat. That only comes from animals. And now it's no longer patting an animal's head and saying, oh, you're a darling little lion. It's not like that anymore. Now it's all changed and it's savagery. And Noah is told, you better be careful because I'm going to put the fear of you in those animals. And if God didn't tell him why, he didn't have to. Was fairly obvious, brothers and sisters. You can't go out in the field anymore and whistle up a lion. You can't do that anymore. But you can in the kingdom, because now it's back to the Garden of Eden, and better, isn't it? And the final picture, of course, is the one we're all waiting to get for. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them nor any heat. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them, and shall lead them unto living waters of living fountains of waters. And this one's hard to believe. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. You ever thought about that, brothers and sisters? Have you ever thought about the people that we know and love in the truth, that their children didn't come into the truth? How do you think it's going to be possible for that to be erased forever? Could it ever be erased from your mind or my mind? We've had 7 children. They're in the truth, hopefully, with ourselves. Of course, they're all of us. We all be together in the kingdom. But what if one or two of them, three or four of them, didn't come into the truth. Would I carry that on in the kingdom? It won't happen. It's miraculous. It has to be. There are sorrows, brothers and sisters, that are carried by others that we know nothing about, who must wonder how on earth God could ever do that. But he can do it. And if we try and imagine how he's going to do it, it'll get us nowhere. You've just got to believe that. Because it's very difficult to imagine how some tears can be wiped away. Because they cut deep. Some people weep for years and years and years and years about things and other people, thinking perhaps they can never ever be erased, but they will be erased. We cry, some of us, at funerals, but we know that they'll be raised. That's fine. But there are things, brothers and sisters, we'd like to see done that won't be done. We are not the judge of all the earth. So we've got to realise that we're reading here divine things, things that are out of our control. But the great, wonderful thing, brothers and sisters, we must never forget, and I have difficulty with this, just as much as you would, the great, wonderful thing we've got to get into our head, it is not impossible with God. It is not. He will wipe away all tears from their eyes. He will do it. He will do that. There's no question of it. And how he will do it is beyond our understanding. But the fact that he will is in the Bible. And we believe that, brothers and sisters. So let us keep pursuing that road. And may it be that, you know, what we said tonight may have some impact upon us to make emphasis upon our need to pick up difficulties out of the way of people. Don't make more difficulties. Pick up the ones you know that are difficult and move them to one side. Make sure that people know they're gone because they know that's been a problem. Don't trip over it. Go down the road that's plain. That's the duty, brothers and sisters, of every brother and sister in our ecclesia, whatever your abilities are, whatever field of endeavour it takes you into. That is your task. Remove obstacles from people. Make life easier for people so that when we get to the kingdom, brothers and sisters, there certainly won't be, in many cases, tears in our eyes for anybody, because we'll all be there together.